you'd start walking mine.
Hey, thank you, Katie and Kay listeners, for joining me on the Meet in the Middle show, where we share dialogue on complex issues with local thought leaders with differing opinions. The hope is for listeners to gain new perspective and empower freedom of expression. I'm Dan Richardson. My email address is richardson@roth.net. And today's topic is a discussion with John Donvan. What's the path back to healthy debate? So my guest today is John Donvan, and he's been the moderator of Open Debate since 2008. Open to Debate is the nation's only nonpartisan debate-driven media organization dedicated to bringing multiple viewpoints together for a constructive, balanced, respectful exchange of ideas. Open Debate is a platform for intellectually curious and open-minded people to engage with others holding opposing views on complex issues. John, Open Debate's moderator-in-chief, is also an author and correspondent for ABC News. He has served as ABC's White House correspondent, along with postings in Moscow, London, Jerusalem, and Amman. John is the co-author of In a Different Key, The Story of Autism. And in addition to premiering his first one-man show, Lose the Kid, in 2013 in Washington, D.C., John is a four-time Emmy Award winner and was a National Magazine Award finalist in 2010. John, thank you for being here and modeling respectful dialogue. It's an honor to have you join me.
It's an honor to be here, Dan. Thanks very much for asking me.
All right. And for our listeners, I will also say that this is my last show, and I figured what better way to end it than to ask the man who helped inspire me to start the show, as John was fortunate enough to share some thoughts a couple of years ago. So thanks for that too, John.
You're welcome.
I'd like to set the stage and provide a little context for this particular show. As I mentioned, your work on Open to Debate not only inspired the concept of my show, but the show was a wonderful oasis of differing yet very informed perspectives, which is what I sought for my own show. What I've learned is that it's one thing to find differing perspectives. It's another to find people willing to respectfully discuss their differing opinions, especially on air. And it's quite another to find people ready and willing to learn from different perspectives through healthy debate. And that's really where this show title comes from, is what have I learned and what do I think is a path forward for our local community to re-engage in more healthy debate? I'm not saying it doesn't exist, but it seems more challenging these days than it did in years past. So first of all, John, will you please share with our listeners the concept and perhaps the intentions behind your show, Open to Debate?
Yeah, I was just thinking about the title of your show, Meet in the Middle, and ours, Open to Debate, and thinking how, in a way, they sound like they're saying the same thing, but I think they're really not, because I'm not sure that the middle exists anymore. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure what it would mean to... If the goal is to get people to agree in the middle, I think that's a really difficult thing. And at Open to Debate, we're kind of okay with the fact that people are going to disagree. We also think it's sort of human to disagree, in some ways necessary to disagree, and that progress is made through disagreement. But the goal of debate is not to come to a solution or come to resolution or to come to agreement. It's in a way, it's the opposite. I mean, if purely defined or as purely understood, debate really is a competition of ideas. And fundamentally, it's a bit of a sport in the sense that it's a competition and it has rules and it has a culture, but one side tends to win and the other side tends to lose. That's how, for example, the, I will say, so-called presidential debates and so-called candidate debates play out. The question always afterwards is, who won the debate? And in our program, Open to Debate, we very much buy into the notion that we're going to bring on two people who disagree with each other, and they're going to argue, but we believe that there's such a thing as good argument, and that its benefit is for not so much for them, for the debaters themselves, not so much for the evolution of their thought, although who knows, that might happen, but for the third party in the process, which is the audience, who's listening to the two sides debate. And we're in a world today where, as everybody knows, we've retreated into our own zones of sympathy and affinity with groups who agree with us. Less and less do we believe in the middle or believe that there's a set of shared ideas, but more and more we tend to believe we have our own ideas and our ideas are right and the other guy's ideas are wrong. And as a result of that, we often don't actually hear the other side's ideas. So we don't understand why they're making the arguments they're making, why they hold the positions that they hold, what their thinking really is, what logic they're applying. Is there any logic to what they're applying? But in a debate, by definition, which again is set up as a little bit of an artificial kind of dialogue. I used the word sport before. The problem with that word is it tends to make light of the importance of a dialogue taking place. I use sport though to evoke the notion that it's a competition and that it's got a winner and a loser and that it's got rules, etc. But it really is an important kind of dialogue. And for that third party, the audience, it's an opportunity to expose themselves to the other side's ideas, because most of us, most of the time, are on one side or the other, not all the time. Some of us are open-minded, some of us haven't reached a conclusion yet and want to hear both sides, but I think for the most part, in most of the debates that we put on and most of the questions we ask, most people already know what they believe. And we think it's useful to use the format of a debate for people who are still have that shred of curiosity or aspiration to be open-minded, to at least hear the other side's argument, because by definition, you're going to get two sides of an argument, which is not what you experience when you're watching, say, most of the cable news channels. You're hearing a prosecution of one side's point of view, and it's attacks on the other side's point of view. You're not hearing a good faith rendition of what your opponent thinks or believes or why or who your opponent really is at core. So I'm taking a very long time to answer this, but our mission has evolved from in its early days when the organization was founded in 2006, and as you mentioned, I joined in 2008. The mission at that point was, we phrased it as to raise the level of public discourse, because we also believe that the competitive nature of debate, it is hoped, compels the debaters to actually present really good arguments and to do it in a really, really fact-filled, logic-based way in order for them to win the debate, in order for them to be persuasive to the third party, the audience, about their point of view. And we also always impose rules of civility, so no personal attacks as a primary rule. And our argument was we can raise the level of civil discourse by staging debates that requires debaters to be really good at arguing. And by really good, we don't mean yelling. We mean being really persuasive because their information is so good. Their logic and reasoning is so good. We've evolved, though, and at that time, our organization was called Intelligence Squared. So some people may recognize that name. And we changed the name in the early part of 2023 to Open to Debate. And our mission evolved to something different, which is not, of course, we still want to raise the level of public discourse, but we wanted to lower the level of polarization in the country. And that's a different mission. And at that time, we stopped emphasizing winning and losing. And by that, I mean in the under Intelligence Squared, we would have the audience at all of the debates were live in front of a live audience, and we would have the audience vote at the beginning of the debate to tell us where they stood on the question being asked, and then we would ask them to vote at the end of the debate to see whose minds had been changed, and we would name as the winner the debate team whose whose vote had gone up the most in percentage point terms. But when we became open to debate early last year, we did away with the vote, and we evolved our mission to trying to lower the level of polarization through debate. And and it's an experiment in a sense, and what we're doing with that is trying to make a different point, not that the best side will win or the most persuasive side will win, but that it's worth listening to what the other side has to say. Mm-hmm. That if you really pay attention to who the other person is and can hear the reasons for their arguments, the assumptions that they're making, where their assumptions come from, what motivates them, you're probably going to be less likely in the end, if you really pay attention to to somebody who's arguing in good faith, you're going to not hate them for having an opinion that differs from yours. And so I would say now our goal is to make the point that through debate, you can realize that you can disagree with somebody, but you don't have to hate them because you disagree with them. And that's addressing a problem that's afloat in our society, which is the animosity, the hatred, the acrimony, the demonization of somebody who disagrees with you. I don't want to be on a stage with that person. I don't want to hear what that person has to say. I don't want to take a minute to entertain their point of view. We think all of that's damaging and dangerous. And to what? To the kind of to the fabric of our society, to what holds us together. And so we want to make the argument, and I hope it's not Pollyannish, but it might be, that we can learn to not to agree with each other, but still learn to respect one another. And, you know, that's a dynamic that does happen within families, and we want to sort of extend that to the larger culture. So what we do, you know, to be really very much briefer than I have been, is every week we get people together. We connect through voice, sometimes with a video. I moderate a debate between two people who disagree on a specific question. The program goes on for about an hour. They make opening statements for four minutes. Then we talk about the topic for about 25 minutes. I ask questions to kind of prompt a deeper understanding of why they disagree, where they disagree, what they think of each other's arguments, what they think of each other's facts and logic. And then in the last part of the debate, we bring in some experts on the topic to ask further questions. And then at the end of the hour, we wrap it up, and I thank everybody. And I usually end up thanking them for being so civil and taking the exercise really seriously, and express hope that the audience has learned something that they didn't know before because they actually listened to somebody's point of view that they hadn't heard before. And we release this on public radio stations across the country. It's also, we have a YouTube site called Open to Debate, and we have a website called opentodebate.org where you can also see all of these debates. We've done, by this time point now, we've done more than 300 debates since we launched.
Wow. It's impressive. Thank you for that work, and I make it a point not to miss any of them because I find them all incredibly valuable. I think I agree with your earlier statement that the titles indicate that we might have opposing goals. I think where there's alignment and where I think it's really important is that both Open to Debate and Meet in the Middle hold two goals at once, and one is, you know, an informative dialogue where the listeners can learn, but also that respectful component. I always appreciate when you show gratitude for those, and pretty much all your guests do. And I think others have made a similar comment about my show, and I say, look, you don't have to stay in the middle, but it's important to be able to meet there and see what common ground there may or may not be, and then you can go back to your sides, but just meet there occasionally. That's not always conveyed in the title. So I do think there's some differences. I think the other thing with my show, I appreciate Open to Debate because there's these topics that I want to learn about. And in some cases, when I was mayor, there were some topics that really were pertinent to whatever we were discussing, but we never had that opportunity at a town meeting to really get into it. And so I think what I wanted to do with the show is is say, what's the next step after you're willing to hear another perspective and perhaps change your opinion? Somebody has to be making decisions while we're in this polarized state. And in my opinion, good local governance is compromising to some degree, and maybe you're not meeting in the middle, but there have to be community decisions made for a community to function. And what Open to Debate is helping us learn how to do that more effectively. So I appreciate that.
Yeah, I agree with you that ultimately a policy, you know, either Main Street is one way or it's two way. You can't have both solutions right. If that's the debate. And somebody's going to be unhappy. But we think that by having a debate about that topic where each side says, here's why it should be two-way, here's what we're going to get, here's some examples from other places, here's what the neighbors are saying, here's what the traffic flows show already. And somebody who only wants the Main Street to be one-way can make the case as well. And in the end, while the decision is going to disappoint those who wanted it to go the other way, they'll at least see that there was a rationale. They'll at least feel that they were heard. And if in the end it turns out that the ultimate decision was terrible, they can always say, well, we told you so. But we told you so in a really meaningful, useful way that may potentially point to a policy shift, you know, the direction for a policy shift in the future.
And perhaps I'll still say hi to you in the grocery store, because there's going to be another issue down the road that we may agree on. So we don't want to sever the communication gap. And I think that's what's really important.
I'm very discouraged by the increasing inability to say hi in the grocery store to somebody who disagrees with you. I'm living in Washington, D.C., and I live in Washington, D.C. That's where I am right now as we're talking. And, you know, I just see it among people, you know, by the way, Washington, D.C., for those who don't know, you know, it really is, it's not just a government place. It's really got, you know, 700,000 people who live here, and kids go to school, and there are grocery stores and neighborhoods and gyms and parks. And there's a lot of people are not working in the government, and they're in the arts, and they're in food, and they're in, you know, technology, things like that. So there's a real community here. But I can see here that, you know, especially since 2016, since the Donald Trump selection, people shunning, really, truly shunning each other and not saying howdy. And that worries me and kind of breaks my heart as well.
You mentioned something that reminded me of one of my shows and how, you know, people shun each other and they're just simply not willing to have a discussion. Early on, I thought of a show title, a topic I want to discuss, and the show title wound up being The Criminal Justice System, Where Law Enforcement and Mental Health Collide. And I thought of two ideal candidates that would bring opposing views. And one of them said, I'm sorry, I won't be on a show with your other guest. I just don't feel that our opinions align. And I tried to make the case that, you know, really that's the point of the show. And I think it could be productive. And ultimately he said, okay, I will. It was a great show. And at the end of the show, this individual said, Dan, I am so glad I participated. I didn't know what so-and-so was doing in their job. And I'm grateful to understand that better. And that to me was like, wow. Okay.
That's like a home run.
Yeah. So it was pretty neat.
I'm sorry to interrupt. Go ahead.
Go ahead, John.
It was just on the point that you made. That's why I jumped in. That we do have the problem that you have of getting people to agree to be on a show with somebody who disagrees with them. It comes up all the time. Every debate we try to have.
Interesting.
We'll go to somebody and they'll say, I don't want to give that person airtime. I don't want to be the reason that person got exposure. I don't believe any of those ideas are valid. And we say, well, why don't you come on the program then and tell us why? You know, meet meet that person and use it, the opportunity to persuade people that they shouldn't be listening to him or not. I mean, we don't phrase it that explicitly. Our point is, why don't you come on and you know, challenge the views that you think are you know, have no validity, and show us why. And a lot of people don't want to do it. Interestingly, I would say people who have especially strong brands tend to be more in that category. Better known people tend to be more in that category. And you know, one issue that we've always wanted to do some sort of debate around climate change, and we have, and we've done various takes on climate change. But we know that there are people out there who think that the issue is being exaggerated. And there are people who think that that's a crazy idea, that it's not being exaggerated whatsoever, that there's an emergency going on here. And it's a topic where those who believe it's an emergency just feel it's dangerous to give any kind of credence, as in a platform on our program, to somebody who doesn't. They just think we're past that point, et cetera. But it all depends on how we phrase the question and what it is we're asking. We're not, at this point, we're not going to do, is climate change real? But we might do, is climate change manageable? Is climate change coming in the next 10 years? Or are we past the point of no return? Which are somewhat less defined questions. And we think, I would like to hear that conversation between two sides, just to, for, you know, for my own edification as well. I don't want to set off a lot of people now on climate change, because there are, we've done, as I said, 300 topics. With every single topic, I have this sense that I can learn something from hearing the two sides disagree in a meaningful way, something that I haven't thought about before. I may not be persuaded in the end, but I at least want to know why they hear it.
Yeah, and chances are your argument will be stronger afterwards, because you better understand the opposing view, and you've thought about it. I had to ultimately shift gears, and the original intent was to always have two guests, but I couldn't, and so oftentimes I would just play devil's advocate as the moderator, and sometimes it worked, and sometimes it didn't, and part of me feels like that sort of failed, because the purpose is to really model freedom of expression. But I was also trying to empower folks that, look, this isn't as painful as you thought it might be, and I'm not going to attack you, nor is the other guest. But anyway, I had to shift focus. And to your point on digging into an issue, I thought guns was one. The title I did, or the show I did on that, was Guns in America, Armed or Dangerous. And I could only find one ultimate guest. But one of the things that I thought of was, can I get folks to agree that there's the gun violence issue and then there's the gun rights issue? And they are separate. They are connected, but they're separate. And so, as talking about solutions and really the challenges, if we can bifurcate them, it might make for healthier dialogue. And in my preparation for that show, that seemed to have some traction. And that was one of my take-homes from the show, is to, just like you say, try and piece it out and focus on where there's common agreement, at least on a topic. So point taken there.
I like that formulation of, I could even see you doing an hour in which, for the first half hour, you have two people who disagree, only two people. But in the first half hour, they talk about gun rights, and in the second half hour, they talk about gun violence, and separate those two questions, but have the same two people argue them. I think could be really quite interesting, especially if they're just willing to listen to each other's arguments. You know, as a moderator of these programs, I've had to learn to do certain things. To be honest, when I first started doing it, I felt that my role was, and again, for the first, until the pandemic, we did them always in front of a live audience, usually on a big stage, usually in New York City and Manhattan, you know, 400 people in the audience, really, really intense, electrified atmosphere. We would have two teams of debaters of two each, so a lot of people on the stage. bright lights and cameras and things like that. And I felt in the beginning that my role was basically to introduce things and to introduce the debaters and introduce the topic and then step back and let it roll. And by my second or third debate, I had already amended that a lot, because it would turn out that the debate would very quickly go off topic. Mm. They would go down some kind of side road. And the problem is at the end of the evening, you know, if we were doing a debate where the question was, cheese salad sandwich, a chicken salad sandwich is better than egg salad sandwich. I'm making this up to be silly, but if the debate was chicken salad sandwich is the superior sandwich in the world, and very quickly they started talking about hamburgers, and then they started arguing about beef production, and they started talking about, you know, hormones and food, and then they started talking about farm policy, and they did that for 15 or 20 minutes because they were getting very upset about it, and they were goading each other onto this topic. At the end of the evening, we wouldn't have talked about chicken salad sandwiches. So I realized I had to intervene a lot to keep things on topic, and learning to interrupt, which I was not natively comfortable doing, became my greatest lesson if you've heard our programs, you've probably heard how I interrupt, which is fairly frequently and I hope as diplomatically as possible.
Very much so.
One of the things I learned to do was at the beginning of a program, I do this also, I sometimes do, you know, for corporations and executive coaching, things like that. I do debates privately. Panels in terms inside of in-house kind of conversations for groups that I want to sort of work through a challenge of some kind that they're disagreeing about. And one of the things I say as a moderator in front of everybody at the very beginning and to the panel, you know, Ms. Smith, Mr. Jones, Mr. Brown, Mr. Black, may I have your permission to interrupt you when I feel it's necessary? And of course all of them say yes at that point.
Sure.
So it's kind of set the table that I'm going to do that and that they've agreed for me to do that. And then I do it because instinctively people will digress from a topic very, very quickly. And that can be fun and entertaining, but it doesn't keep you focused on the question in the way that you need to be focused in order to be drawing some conclusions at the end of the dialogue. So that was a lesson that that I learned, and that it's one that drives me crazy when I see the debates on television and the presidential debates on television and the moderators sitting there saying nothing as things go off the rails, which happens so often.
Well, not only do I think you interrupt tactfully and respectfully, there are times where you will interject and either ask the guest to clarify something they have said that they assume the audience understands, or you will do that. And I think it's so useful, at least it is for me, so much appreciated. What about, I tend to correlate, I won't even lead with that. So I'll just ask, how about listening skills? In your experience, are you able to draw any correlations between good listeners and good debaters? Does good listening typically lead to a person being more influential or not necessarily?
I think the answer is yes in the format of our debate. So it was a little bit different when we had a live audience, but I asked our live audience to listen closely. I would say to them, and I would go out and have a little warm-up talk with the audience, and I would tell them how things are going to unfold, and then I would say, we're asking all of you to be the judges of the quality of the argument being made here, and so I would like you to listen closely and see if these debaters are actually making good points, whether they're actually asking the questions that I've asked, whether they're actually answering each other's questions to one another, whether they're actually providing evidence. And, you know, in your keep a mental tally of who's good at that, who's really doing that. And so with an audience charged with that expectation of the debaters, my feeling is that the debaters who demonstrated that they were participating in that way, that they were truly listening to the points that their opponents were putting forward and responding truly to those points, not just brushing past them to rush to their own talking points, but truly engaging with the other side, showing that they were listening, had therefore gained more credibility with our audience, because our audience was expecting to see that. So whether that happens out in the real world, I don't know whether listening brings credibility. I tend to think that it does, because it also helps to underline empathy and understanding. If you can, without having to agree with your opponent's point of view, if you could make your opponent's point of view accurately, if your opponent has just said, to go back to the chicken salad sandwich again, if your opponent has just said, chicken salad is terrible unless it's on whole wheat toast, and it's all about the texture of the toast and without it, and if the guy goes on and on and on about the toast, et cetera, if the opponent doesn't agree, but starts his argument by being able to recite what he just heard, all right, I'm going to disagree with you. Now, I hear you saying that it's the toast and it's the consistency and it's the crunch and it's the color that comes. And those, I get it. Those things are all important. But that's not what we're talking about here. So we're not talking about what the bread is about. We're talking about what's inside the bread. And I want to say what's inside the bread matters so much more, because bread. So my point being that if that person has reflected that they've really heard the other side, I think they gain credibility and respect from the audience for being able to do that. And we do a little bit of coaching of the debaters, not on the substance of what they're going to say, because we don't want to impact that, but we give them some formality type of guidance. For example, we tell them you can only talk for 4 minutes at the beginning and your opening, but we also say, you know, try not to read a script. Just try to talk from the heart. And another thing we say is we really, really recommend that you study ahead of time what your opponent has written about this topic and be ready to respond to what they've had to say. But we also want you to think through, what are the weaknesses in your argument that your opponent's probably going to pick at? Mm-hmm. And what is your response going to be at that? And so one of the things that, you know, we all but say is, you know, could you make your opponent's argument if that was your mission? If you had to be an actor and pretend you were your opponent, could you make their argument in a way that's put their best foot forward and be fair? And that requires knowing who your opponent is and what they think. And when in the flow of the debate, it requires listening to them, really, really listening.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to interrupt for a second and say we just passed the bottom of the hour, and that you are listening to the Meet in the Middle show on KDNK Community Access Radio. I'm the host, Dan Richardson, and my guest is John Donvan. Today's show is a discussion with John Donvan. What's the path back to healthy debate? John, one thing that you and I are connected through autism as well. I work for Ascendigo, and you wrote, you co-authored In a Different Key, and were involved in the movie production of that. And so one of the things that I'm constantly telling my staff, probably at nausea to them, is I talk about the platinum rule. That's not my term, that's someone else, but the golden rule is to treat others as you want to be treated, but others may not want to be treated that way, so we need to understand the other person, understand how they want to be treated. They may not like direct communication, or they may like communication in a different way. And that's what I think of when you talk about that active listening. And I think there's data out there that shows that people can tell if they're being listened to sort of in an authentic way. And in your show, it sounds like your experience is that it offers credibility. I would say that out on the street in community discussions, it may solve some of the problem just by listening to that person and letting them know that they've been heard, even though you may not find that common ground. And I think that's just essential. But before the show, you and I briefly talked about autism. And I'm curious, for those of you who haven't read In a Different Key or seen the movie, it's a wonderful window and history to autism. And it really helps explain autism, not only autism spectrum disorder, but the community and how it impacts those impacted by it really well. And I wondered if you would share some thoughts on what have you seen as it relates to this issue in the autism community, and what are some highlights from the book that you might want to share?
Well, the book is different from the film, even though they both have the same name and have some overlapping elements. But the book is 100% a history of the diagnosis, while the film is a present-day depiction of the lives of people on the spectrum and challenges they face from the reality that a lot of other people don't get what autism is or what autistic is, and is kind of a gentle nudge, call to action for folks who don't know much about autism to be, more accepting and understanding. And the film does that with a lot of humor and kind of interesting background information and, fascinating characters and some moments of outrage as well. The book is all history and starts with the diagnosis of the first child diagnosed in 1943, a boy named Donald Triplett, who became a man named Donald Triplett, who is featured in the book and in the film. Donald died last year, actually, and my colleague Karen Zucker and I, who wrote the book and made the film together, and is the mother of an autistic man, I got to know Donald very, very well, and we actually attended his funeral last year, and got to see him in his last days when he was in hospice. And the wonderful thing about Donald's experience in life—he lived in a little town in Mississippi—is that his community was completely accepting of him all of his life, or nearly all of his life. Once he got into school, and they got to know him as a child back in the 1930s. They really have accepted him ever since. So by the time we showed up in this little town called Forest, Mississippi, he was a fixture in town, and he was appreciated and respected. He wasn't patronized. He was befriended. It's a big difference. And the interesting thing for both the book and the film is that Donald's treatment by the community was the exception for decades and decades of how people with autism were responded to and treated by society at large. And their families as well were often stigmatized and in some ways brutalized, certainly psychologically. There was a time when mothers were blamed for causing autism in their children. And there was a time when autism was seen completely as a negative thing. And that evolution has been dramatic to the point today where autism, the acceptance of autistic people is much higher than it used to be. The stigma has dropped off enormously. The tendency of psychiatry to try to encourage parents to institutionalize autistic children has pretty much come to an end. With exceptions being people who have profound autism, but nobody's recommending that they go into the old institutions that used to be there. But there's advocacy for group homes and other kinds of communities that can be truly supportive and gentle and loving and caring and protective. But what we also explored in the film is that autism has launched 1,000 arguments, 1,000 bitter, nasty arguments over the course of its development as a diagnostic concept. And the arguments have been about a whole bunch of things, from what is the cause of autism? What is the meaning of autism in a person's life? What is the treatment for autism? It just goes on and on and on. And people outside, those who are connected to autism by being autistic or a family member or working in the field as a professional, this group refers to itself, generally speaking, as the autism community. And it's not a community in the real sense, but it's a way to delineate those who know something about autism from those who don't. And so outside the autism community, I think people are unaware of the fact of how riven by argumentation, not nice argumentation, not healthy argumentation, the autism community is over these kinds of issues. They may have had some glimpse into this 20 years ago when the idea emerged that autism was caused by vaccines, which has been largely debunked. But that was a very, very, very bitter argument. And there are arguments to this day about the appropriate kinds of treatments, whether behavioral therapy is appropriate or not. It goes on and on and on. And so that's where I see overlap with the other thing we're talking about, is that within this community that has this shared experience, that commonality of experience does not bind everybody together. And in some ways, it divides them by the ways in which they can see the differences in their experiences. And it's a theme that we explore in the book more than in the film. The film is it's almost such inside baseball that for the film it was not appropriate to delve into that, because we really just wanted to kind of open people's eyes to being supportive of people on the spectrum. But the book goes into it more. And our conclusion as to why the autism community is so riven by these various kinds of disagreements is because the concept of the diagnosis itself is pretty messy. It's pretty unclear. It's not really very clear what we mean when we talk about what is autism. And to people who haven't heard that before, that might sound really surprising. But it's not. It's a diagnosis that only came into focus in the 1930s, 1940s. It's not that there weren't people before that who would have qualified for the diagnosis. It's that the way of seeing them didn't exist yet. The way of seeing them as autistic and defining them that way didn't exist yet. But even after it came into existence, even after the diagnosis was crystallized, it kept changing. It got broader. It got narrower. It added more people. It dropped people. It split into subcategories. It got rid of the subcategories. And the reason for that is autism is not any kind of syndrome that depends on biological markers that can be tracked. It's based on, even though it's believed that autistic difference is based in brain wiring and has genetic impact and genetic influences, it's so complex that nobody can say this is the thing that is making somebody autistic or not. So the way that autism is diagnosed is by observation of an individual's behaviors and looking at them against a checklist of supposed traits. And I say supposed because the traits have changed again and again and again over time as people, well, this should count, that and that can't count. So that's our theory, that the argument stems from the fact that the term is so poorly defined. And how that comes back to debate, and it happens a lot in our debates. When we have a debate on a particular topic, we have to make sure everybody agrees on what the words mean in the question. And that can be very, very tricky. If we did a debate on... I'll cite an example. We did a debate where the resolution was the world is better off without religion. And one might say, oh, that's really obvious, but people might disagree on what better off means and what is better and what world. And so we work very, very hard at getting the language of our debate questions right, getting it precise, making sure that the two sides agree that they're actually debating about the same thing. And I think in the autism world, that same thing problem exists, and in our debates, it does come up sometimes. We think we've nailed it, and then we realize as the debaters are talking that they don't really think they're talking about quite the same thing, and that's a tricky thing also. So I think that's where we've become very, you know, where experience has taught us to be better at it. The reason we think we're like, you know, near the top of this field of presenting debates is because we've done it for so long that we're very aware of this problem and challenge. And the way we resolve that is we talk to both sides ahead of time and say, this is what we mean by this. Do you agree that we're talking about that? And you know, getting that sorted out ahead of time is really, really important to having the debate work.
Is the show you were referencing, is that the title was, Is Religion a Force for Good?
No, that was a more recent one.
Because okay. I wrote that down specifically because I thought exactly what you just said, that, wow, that's a really poignant, well-crafted question. So it's clear that you put a lot of thought into that.
Yeah.
So what I took from your discussion of autism in your book In a Different Key, similar to what we were talking a minute ago, that, you know, here's a community that there's inevitably so much common ground and certainly common intentions, but they're divided by words or perspectives. And I've thought through my own experiences that if you can just parse it out and say, well, let's talk about, you know, financial support or, you know, the different levels of direct support needed for individuals, and so that you can start closing that gap. But it's difficult, and the emotions involved in a family with a person with autism, I can't begin to understand. So the divide continues, unfortunately.
Yeah, I mean, even a fundamental one that I think people outside the autism community can get, like, really quickly, is that is autism to be recognized as a disability or not? Because right. there are people who have the diagnosis of autism who bitterly resent the notion that there's anything about them that needs to be put into the book of a psychiatry book as a disability or a developmental challenge. Because, you know, the argument being blonde isn't a disability, but that's the difference. And I think differently and I operate differently and I have different sensory experiences. That doesn't make me less or under in any way. And those individuals have a really, really good point. Their experience of autism does, you know, it comes with, for them, social challenges, but they don't, for them, the solution to their social challenges is for other people to sort of roll with who they are and be accommodating. And that doesn't mean that they are, quote unquote, broken, and they don't want to be portrayed that way. On the other hand, there are individuals who have the diagnosis of autism in which that diagnosis means that they're totally incapable of leading independent lives because they need 24-hour care, because they would be taken advantage of in the broader society if they were out in the world operating on their own. My brother-in-law is one of those people. He's very, very profoundly autistic, and he lives in a residence where he's watched 24 hours, not that there's a camera on him, I don't mean that, or there's somebody looking through his door. He's in a place where there's somebody, you know, to oversee that he's okay 24 hours a day, providing his meals, because he couldn't do that for himself. That's what I mean by 24 hours a day. Helping him get from the apartment that he lives in to the room where he likes to paint, because he wouldn't be able to find his way there, or manipulate the paint box locker without a whole lot of training, which he's getting. So I'm sure at this point he can find his way and open the box, but he needs a lot of training to do that. And he's not able to speak more than a few words, and he doesn't have any understanding in how the larger society works. And so the question is his autism the same as the person that I was just talking about with autism who is, in fact, if anything, proud of the difference of being autistic? That's one of those tensions that exists, and it's really fundamental. And the autism community divides very, very sharply over that, those differences between those two presentations of autism. And I'm sure I'm sure that one side or the other of those differences will take issue with how I described it, because there's high sensitivity. And I can only I can only plead. I don't mean offense. I'm trying to understand. I'm doing my best, and I'm willing to hear you out if you think anything I said was wrong, and I'll adapt if I think I should adapt, and if you make a good case.
Yeah, and to an earlier point you made, if the alternative is to just not talk about it, I don't think that's progress either.
Right.
So I appreciate attempts to try and dig into these issues. This hour is flying by. We have a little over 5 minutes left, and I want to shift gears slightly. And while we certainly can't blame Congress for all of our communication and polarization, it certainly is a poster, maybe the poster child for polarization. And I'm curious if the Speaker of the House or the President of the United States said, John, help us work through this polarization in Congress. And we need whether it's a process or a job orientation handbook, what comes to mind? So you talked about open debate as, it's okay if to disagree. And then I talked about local governance where at some point a decision has to be made. Are there certain things that a body like Congress could work on that you think would increase discourse and reduce polarization?
I think right now there's a practice in Congress on both sides actually, to whip up feelings around identity and to make issues not what's good for everybody, but who you are and whether this is for you as opposed to them. And I don't think this is new. I think it's been going on for building up for 20 or 30 years, but it's really, really necessary now not to show that you got the best deal for your constituents, but also that in doing so, you defeated the other guys. You put them down. And I'm a little loath to say there was a golden time or a better time, because it's easy to look back in the past and think that. But I do think that there was much more willingness on the part of members of Congress to disagree on the policy and still be friends. And the fact that they were still friends left room for them to spend time meeting in the middle, because there can be a middle on, even on an issue where people disagree, they're going to disagree about a lot of the issue around the issue, but there's going to be parts of it where they actually do have common ground. And from that common ground, if they can stake that out, they may still have parts where they disagree, but they can find the areas where they disagree meaningfully and celebrate the win-win. Nobody wants to celebrate a win-win anymore. They want to celebrate the we win, we do, and we crush them. You look at that's echoed in these YouTube debates where you see, the headline of the debate is blah 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 destroys, set the other person. And you see that about members of Congress. You see little clips of exchange. AOC destroys Marjorie Greene Taylor. Marjorie Greene Taylor destroys AOC. And that's kind of celebrated. And I think Congress has bought into that dynamic. So I think I don't have a solution to that, because all I would be doing is preaching to them, say, please stop doing that. But I think if they could stop doing that, that would help a lot. And when it comes, this has leaked over into the presidential debates. We're now going to have a debate season that's not managed by the Presidential Debate Commission, which is in Washington anyway, seen as a pretty big deal. This was a nonprofit bipartisan group that ran the debates since 1976, I think. And both the Biden administration and the Trump teams have pushed them aside, and they're going to have their own debates. And open to debate, we're very big critics of the presidential debates. We think they're terrible, and we don't think they're debates. We think they're parallel press conferences where they don't actually debate anything. The tendency has been for a journalist sitting in the chair to ask each of them a question, and then they respond to the question, and the other person gets 30 seconds to put the first person down.
Yeah.
And they're not really, you know, if they were to do it our style, we would ask them, tonight's debate is, should the United States, I'm making this one up now, tonight's debate, it's a foreign policy debate. We're not going to do our foreign policy. We're going to ask a question. We want to see how you think about it. Is Ukraine worth American money? Is saving Ukraine worth taxpayers' money? That would be the debate. And they would have to stay on that topic. And they would have to tell us how they think. And they would have to tell us how they would do it. And they would have to tell us why they would do it. And they would have to tell us what they think the consequences of their position would be. And each would have to respond to what the other one had to say. That would be a debate. And that's the way we would want to do it. But these guys are never going to,
right.
I think, would never agree to do it this way. But that would show so much more. Yes, it's true we wouldn't cover Taiwan, and it's true we wouldn't cover free trade, and we wouldn't cover China, and those are all important issues. But we would be showing how they think about one important thing, because really, really, if it's a debate where they ask a question about China and Taiwan and free trade, are we really learning anything from
right.
that kind of program?
Right.
No, never.
Yeah. I think that's I think we're a ways away from that, but I think that's a great guiding light, and I appreciate that. We are just about at the end of the show. Thank you, John Donvan, for joining me today. It was a true honor. Today's show was
good
a
for me too.
Okay. Today's show was a discussion with John Donvan. What's the path to healthy debate? I'm Dan Richardson, and my email address is richardson@roth.net. Thank you for listening to KD&K and Meet in the Middle Show and giving me this opportunity to unpack many complex issues, to better understand many local thought leaders, and hopefully empower freedom of expression. Thanks for joining us on KD&K. And again, John, thank you. What an honor it is. And good luck with your future shows.
Thank you, Dan.
All right. Take care.
It was 700 fence posts from your place to ours. Neither one of us was old enough to drive a car. Sometimes it was raining.